This is part B of our conversation with the CEO of Greenpeace, David Ritter. If this is the first time you're hearing David Ritter, go back to part A and pick up the first part of the two-part series of the David Ritter conversation.
You said part way too many times.
I did. Okay, I'm going to switch gears with my next question. So you've been at the helm of Greenpeace for 12 to 13 years.
Eight years. I've been with Greenpeace for 13, head of Australia, yep, in Australia Pacific, right? I was in London, yep, for five before that.
Yep. As a leader, how have you changed from day one when you first walked into the office as CEO and to today?
I look back ruefully on walking in 8 years ago, and I guess I'd held leadership positions of various kinds before, you know, vice captain of the junior cricket club, whatever it might be. I mean, you know, I guess the most important formative experience was that I'd been principal legal officer at an Indigenous land council, and you know, I'd had a very, very good and not insignificant team to lead, and some incredibly important work and a fantastic client base, the communities we served. But I still hadn't, it still wasn't the loneliness of being the ultimate decision maker in the organization.
Mm.
And I think I look back and I think I was just wildly unprepared.
yeah.
And it's not that I think there was necessarily very much I could have done to prepare better. But I look back and I've learnt a lot about everything from the macro to the micro, you know, the little routines that mean that your days are as productive as possible, and that, you know, you do treat these jobs as a marathon rather than a sprint, to use a cliche.
Mm.
And look, there was probably one early crunch point where I was about, I don't know, roughly a year in, and my mother died. She was 85 and she had a terrific life, but yeah, I was very close to her. I'd thought to myself, I'll go back to Sydney, and there was one public thing that had been sort of booked into the, my mother died in Perth, so go back to Sydney. And there was one public event that had been in the diary for a very, very long time, and I thought, my mum was a big one for, you know, keeping her obligations, so I'll, in the spirit of that, I'll go and I'll do that, and then I'll take, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever time I need, and my board chair was wonderfully supportive about that. But then just as this happened, the Russian government decided to storm one of our ships, the Arctic Sunrise, and to lock up 30 of our people in Russia. And one of those was one of my staff.
Right.
A 27-year-old young woman. And another one was an Australian who was not part of my staff, but still an Australian. Butte bloke called Colin. and I felt an enormous responsibility, as you would, even though I wasn't part of the response team, because Australia is a long, long way away from Northern Europe. But I was obviously responsible for our domestic response to those particular two individuals' cases. And I could just hear my mother's voice in my head talking about responsibility and worrying about the 27-year-old woman, Alex. If my mother had still been alive. And so I sort of locked the grief inside a box, you know, in one of those secret recesses of the heart, and went back to work. And, you know, you work as hard as you can in those circumstances. And sometimes you're not working very sensibly because, you know, the real ops room was in Northern Europe. So some of the time it really was just, you know, it's almost a make work when you feel as responsible as that. And then, you know, with great strategy and great luck, after 67 days of imprisonment, our people were released, and Colin was the very last to be released. By accident, he happened to be the last. And after that had happened, I was standing in our kitchen, in the place we were renting at that stage in Newtown. And I just started physically shaking. and the grief, the relief came out, and the grief came out, and I'd been working in a way that was not sustainable. I'd been making suboptimal decisions in the workplace. And I had a good long, hard, my board chair, who was fantastic, a woman called Lena, she's terrific, had a really good long, hard conversation with me, which is around, look, you've just got to be in this for the long haul. And that means managing yourself better. So,
yeah,
you know, you've got to get more sleep. Stop trying to deal with, you know, the workload arithmetically and, you know, just get on with it. And, I think that was maybe the biggest of them in some ways, but you look back on kind of errors of judgment, and you hope that you learn from them.
Mm. Does the mission feel, I don't know, more achievable now than it did back then, or back then compared to now?
Wow. Well, look, in a physical sense, I'd certainly rather start from where we were 8 years ago, because there was less, you know, less carbon pollution circulating around in the sky. We had more time, and you know, there were more trees standing and more fish swimming and more coral.
Yeah.
You know, we've had three great bleachings of the Great Barrier Reef, since 2012, which have wiped out more than half of the corals. So in terms of the physical environment, of course, it was easier to start in 2012 than in 2021. But in terms of where the politics is, we are on the move.
Yeah.
We are on the move. Things are happening. The level of action and ambition now being manifested in the capitals of the world, from Washington to Berlin via London and Seoul and so on, is finally getting towards where we need to be. The scale of community support in Australia, that we've now got 80% of the population, 80%, who now want climate action. Now that we have big corporates who are, you know, reluctantly, of course, they would rather that they simply had a regulatory environment that enabled them to do the job, but they are stepping forward now. So we are at last belatedly on the move. So it is just this really extraordinary race that we are in, where, you know, we are coming from this standing start because of the lies and because of the vested interests and because of the inactivity. But at last we are on the move. And so there is this sense of extraordinary momentum, you know, the helter skelter of the next critical decade that is in front of us, where no matter how fast we go, it still isn't going to be fast enough. And in being fast, that we must take the community with us, so that no Australian is left behind, so that people are not left behind anywhere in the world. And so that we also, ensure that the solutions are solutions that are going to also be good for nature, the sort of the solutions that have those co-benefits, to use the jargon. So yeah, look, it's a physically I'd rather be back in 2012, but look, you know, in terms of where we are with momentum, we are moving.
It is happening. Yeah. That is brilliant. Hey, when I spoke to you about a week ago, we were talking about, you know, how you, where you grew up, and you said there's sort of four defining moments in your life. And, you know, you said number one is the influence of peers and teachers to a 16-year-old in his first year of university. You said two, too often the law is made by those on the riverbank and not those who are drowning. Three, it was a moment up a hill in New Zealand. Can't wait to hear about that one. And four, the decision to join Greenpeace were all defining moments. Take us to number one, the influence of peers and teachers to a 16-year-old in your first year of university. Firstly, what 16 in uni? How did that happen?
I missed a year of school at one point, so I just ended up at university a year early. And, you know, I absolutely loved uni at 16, but I probably wasn't emotionally ready for it in many ways. I moved into a hall of residence because I didn't have my driver's license, and the buses were pretty rubbish to and from where my folks lived. I really wasn't ready for it. And it's not that I led a sort of, you know, particularly wild youth. I was just a bit not ready. Pretty young.
Yeah.
And I looked like I was about 12. I'm sort of one of those people who went from, you know, looking like I was about 12 to looking like I'm about 80 in about 5 minutes sometime in my mid 30s. with sort of, you know, none of the good stuff in between. I was exposed to, some brilliant teachers who really, you know, made plain the full sweep and passion of politics and history. And I'll mention some names if that's okay, but
for sure,
like, a historian called Richard Bosworth, another historian called Rob Stewart, extremely influential people to me, a law professor called Richard Bartlett, and there were, you know, many others. And then the students. I mean, I was very, very lucky to fall in with, a group of really extraordinary student activists. Some of them have gone on to very respectable positions, so I won't mention their names, but particularly there were a group of women who were very serious in their political analysis for sort of 17, 18, 19 year olds. And I just learned a very great deal from them about how you, go about thinking of yourself as a serious political person in the world. I mean, you know, we're of course no doubt insufferable in the way that look, I'm sure I was insufferable at the time, but it felt like a really great education. And, you know, one of the things that I guess I could have read from books or experienced in other ways, but really was, imbued in me at that point, is that political change is driven by people.
Yeah.
It is driven by organized people, by people working together. And so all of that progress that I was getting so excited about a few minutes ago, that did not happen by itself. It happened because of the extraordinary energy of human beings working together to achieve massive political change. And so the announcements in those capitals, those announcements, these were not bestowed from on high. These were announcements that were driven by organized people, and people are an endlessly renewable source of energy. So, you know, that sense of political change being possible and how you go about it and the joy in it as well.
Yeah.
The joy of being in that kind of work was, you know, really came through very strongly from that group of teachers and that group of kids.
Mm. Too often the law is made by those on the riverbank and not those who are drowning.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So I was struggling a bit in my law degree initially. I struggled to connect to the way in which it was taught, which was a set of fairly dispassionately rendered hypothetical problems that you were meant to interpret on the basis of having read statute and case law. And I was struggling with it. And then one day a guest lecturer, Alan Hutchison, from Canada, comes in, and I may be imagining this, but I remember him as having a little bit of the sort of shuffle of a prize fighter. And he sort of, you know, shuffles into the microphone, and there are a few preliminaries, and then he just comes out with this statement: too often law is made by those on the riverbank and not the, or made for those on the riverbank and not for those who are drowning. And I just put down my pen and I look up at this bloke and I think, ah, shit, this is what it's all about.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of uptick in my grades following this moment as I suddenly, it all sort of suddenly clicks. And I end up, you know, writing my final year honours project on, the Mabo decision, which has sort of just been handed down. And then, you know, that clicks into, you know, roughly a decade spent working as a native title and land rights lawyer, working, for those who have been, you know, subjected to so much injustice as a consequence of Australian, invasion and colonisation. And then it flows through into the sort of the analysis, I guess, that I brought to Greenpeace, which is that the legal system in this country, is not set up to look after people and nature. And so that legal system, needs challenging. And that doesn't mean I don't believe in the rule of law. I profoundly believe in the rule of law. But the rule of law, but the content of laws, should reflect in a fundamental way, the flourishing, the need to guarantee the flourishing of people and of nature.
You found yourself up a hill in New Zealand. tell us about that moment, up a hill in New Zealand. What does it mean? Yeah, look, what does it mean, David?
Look, as you do. I mean, I'd been brought over, and I was still a native title lawyer at the land council I worked for then. I'd been brought over to speak, alongside, the, judge that was the head of the Waitangi Tribunal over there, opening a conference about law and history and, you know, but I was there a little bit early, and I was there by myself, and it was the sort of the day before, and I didn't know anyone, and so, you know, sort of climbed a hill. And the thing about climbing a hill with some space around you is that you and these happily were the days before screens followed you everywhere, is that you've got to confront yourself. And I found myself thinking about some of the recent conversations I'd had with, clients who were, you know, people I knew pretty well, had sort of said, look, you know, we know why you're here, David, but there's more going on for us than the legal process. There's stuff going on in our communities. And look, I did find myself thinking about, some of what we were seeing in relation to climate and environment. And I think Gore's film may have already been out by that stage. And if not, then certainly there was already plenty of anger about, John Howard's lack of action on climate. You're also, of course, up a hill by yourself. You're there with the world, and the world sort of looks back at you and says, well, you know, what are you going to do on your journey? And so it was sort of the moment when I thought, much as I think lawyers play an incredibly valuable role, can play an incredibly valuable role in society, and law is important, that I wanted to go from being a lawyer and taking instructions from my clients, to being someone who was all in, to someone who was in the arena, not taking instructions from anyone else, and working in the deepest possible way on the structural causes of injustice, of the destruction of the natural world, and of inequality. And again, not because, I particularly wanted to wallow in it, but out of love.
Yeah.
But because people are innately good, and the world is a magnificent place. And so, you know, it was a sort of conversation. I mean, this doesn't sound great, but a sort of conversation with myself up a hill in New Zealand about, you know, how you put all that you are in the service of all that you believe in.
Beautiful. And then that decision to join Greenpeace.
Look, I'd love to be able to tell you that I just marched straight off a hill.
Yeah, in the front door.
The Rainbow Warrior that happened to be, you know, docked in Auckland or something, but no, it wasn't quite like that. It takes me then a little bit of time. And remembering that I'm still at this stage, I'm still giving my $30 a month to Greenpeace, yeah, which I had been for, you know, a decade or more. And, you know, it's always worth mentioning that independence, that we never take any money from any government or any business. So, you know, the $30 a month is really super important. And I didn't have a plan to go and work for Greenpeace, but I followed my, wonderful wife. She'd been my girlfriend, but I'd been up the hill and she was my wife by the time I followed her to the UK and sort of turned up in London really needing a job, but just being, and the one thing I was sure about is I didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. And so I was looking for jobs where I could work on, the foundations, the structural foundations of environmental, damage, of injustice, of inequality. And, you know, there were a bunch of jobs at great organizations and there are lots of great organizations out there. No question. and one of those was Greenpeace. And I looked at it and I thought, can this be real? Senior campaigner. Wow. What does that mean? How do you do that? And I sort of read through the job description. I'd not been a campaigner in, or at least not as I understood it. But then I looked through the job description and I realized that a lot of the work that I'd done as a lawyer, had really verged on campaigning.
Mm.
But also I had in a sort of voluntary capacity worked on any number of campaigns or protests. I mean, all sorts of issues, you know, homelessness, peace stuff, a whole range of environmental things from time to time, but it had never been my job before. And this was about going from, seeing yourself as a volunteer in these things to being a full-time campaigner. I was very, very, very fortunate because I had a monumentally terrible start to the interview. Very, very fortunate that they had three jobs going and, I think I was the third of the three candidates they decided to give a run. And 13 years later, here we are.
Well, they were right, weren't they? Although you mightn't have got the first, but you weren't first pick. Look at you now. Look at you now.
I don't think I've ever been the first pick for any job I've ever got, to be honest.
That's all right. Has anyone?
No, look, I don't know, but there is something in that. And I mean, I'm really grateful to them for taking the chance on me and also for being patient because I don't think I was very good at the campaigning gig for quite a while. It really was an adjustment to go from being a lawyer to being a campaigner. And also, you know, to be honest, I struggled probably more than you should in going from living and working in Australia. And I'd only ever lived and worked in Perth and then being sort of 36 and living and working in London. And I did, you know, the cultural jumps really matter. And I think I remember doing an interview with, one of the UK, TV stations about the European Common Fisheries Policy and just hearing the twang in my head of my own voice and feeling suddenly self-conscious about that.
Well, what's obvious that's come through in this interview, and we're really mindful of the time and we're very grateful for the amount of time you've given us today, is you're very passionate about what you're doing, and that in all of our interviews, our audience loves hearing how people are passionate about what they do, be that their main role or their, you know, their side hustle, as they say. What's your advice for people out there who are pursuing a passion or want to actually know, well, I actually don't know what my passion is. How do I find it? Because it sort of seems like it came to you in a few different ways.
Up a hill.
Up a hill. Where can other people find their hill?
Yeah, look, it's the eternal question. And not everyone can work for Greenpeace. I mean, we have 1.2 million people in our supporter network in Australia Pacific, and we have 45 staff. So not everyone who loves Greenpeace or feels some affinity to Greenpeace can work for Greenpeace. So my advice, you know, I feel you're always mindful of how hollow it feels in a way of the giving of advice because every life's journey is just so different and you want to be deeply respectful of that. But my advice has to be, honestly born out of the moment that we're in, where we have a shrinking fraction of a time to hold off the worst of climate change and to build through a bridge to an earth capable of nurturing life in all of its magnificent diversity. And, you know, if you want a sort of pop cultural reference, you know, there's the first of the sort of, you know, 10 or whatever there are now Mission Impossible films where at the absolute climax, Tom Cruise is being chased through a tunnel by, the villain, and there's a helicopter in the tunnel and he's attached to a train and the helicopter crashes and then is going to come and kill him, and the helicopter blade is spinning faster and faster and faster, and then the rotor stops just an inch or so away from his throat. I mean, that is roughly where we are in relation to global warming.
Mm-hmm.
And if we pull out all the stops, we can keep the rotors away. And that then creates the opportunity for regeneration and recovery and rebuilding. But, you know, that's kind of the degree of urgency. So having in mind that degree of urgency, none of us need have an existential crisis about what to do with our lives. And so I would urge anyone listening to think about all that you love.
Yeah.
Think about all that you love. And then think about really deeply, you know, imagine yourself cradling the child you love most in the world in your arms. Imagine taking a breath in the natural place in the world that you care about most deeply. Think of the animal that for you symbolizes all that is most wonderful about nature. Think of the cities, the parks, the places you love, and know that all of it is in mortal jeopardy from climate change. Now think about what it would feel like if on the foundations of that love, you looked at all around you and said, how can I use the power that is at my disposal? And we all have power. How can I use that power to make the biggest change of which I am capable, and will then trust in others to do the same? And that biggest change will never come from individual actions of consumption or anything like that. I mean, you should do those things because we should all try and live good lives according to our values. But where you can really exercise power for big change is inside your institutions, inside your workplace, your neighborhood, your school, your union, your church, your sports club, you know, whatever it might be. And you can do three things. You can adopt the don't buy, don't supply, say why, trio of things to do. So don't buy, shift whatever it is, or work in combination with others to shift whatever it is, your business, your school, your place of worship, whatever it might be, to buying only clean electricity. Then you can go down the path of don't supply. So if you are a business, you can say, we will not supply services to the fossil fuel industry. We will do what Bishop Desmond Tutu said was now time for almost a decade ago now, which is a kind of apartheid-style treatment of the fossil fuel industry. We will simply no longer sell our services to the fossil fuel industry. If you are an artistic organisation or a health organisation, you can refuse sponsorship. And we saw a hospital refuse $15 million worth of sponsorship from a coal company.
Wow.
A couple of years, roughly 18 months ago. We've seen declarations of communications consultants, of media organizations, of engineers, of other professionals saying, we will not do work for fossil fuel companies. We saw an extraordinary letter written by one of the preeminent actors of our time, Mark Rylance, leaving the Royal Shakespeare Company because they refused to cut links with the fossil fuel industry. So this is becoming, you know, a wave of just refusing to resupply, refusing to stay part. And then you can say why. You can if you're a big organization that has decided you will no longer buy dirty coal power, you will say proudly, we're going to wind and solar because that is the right thing to do, and because there is the strongest business case for it. So what I would encourage, think about all your love, convert that love into action for people, for nature, for all that we care about, and do that where you stand, using all of your power to shift all of the institutions where you can have some influence. And whether you are the CEO of the world's largest bank, or you're the fella that organises the sandwich run at the local cricket club on the weekend, we are all part of things that are bigger than ourselves where we can have influence.
Great advice. One more question, David. We're just about out of time, but we always like to ask our guests this final question. What's next on your to-do list?
Well, what is next on my to-do list? I'm going to answer that in two ways. There's a weekend coming up, and it's been a long week already, and I'm really, really looking forward to just having a bit of a quiet Saturday with my girls, because I do dote on them, and there's that time. So in the immediate sense, I'm going to tell you the truth. That is absolutely what I'm looking forward to.
Beautiful.
In the next 24 hours. Lifting the eyes to a different kind of horizon. We have had this monumentally successful so far re-energise campaign Greenpeace has in Australia, shifting all of these major Australian corporations to adopt 100% clean electricity before 2025. But there are plenty of other corporations that we still need to shift. So, for example, we've seen commitments from Telstra and from TPG Vodafone, but where is Optus? So come on, Optus. This company is on the to-do list. On the retail side, I've mentioned Woolworths and Aldi and Coles, but where is Kmart, for example? So there are a whole lot of other businesses that we are now going to be very energetically trying to shift to make those commitments. And really, they are just commitments that are expected of them by their own customers, by their own stakeholders, by their own employees. You know, what we know is that a significant majority of Australians simply expects that any responsible business will now power their operations through wind and through solar, through clean electricity, not through dirty, burning coal. And then the other big to-do, which I'm feeling full of energy about because the campaign launched just 2 days ago, is around Australia's biggest polluter, AGL. Now, AGL is a company that is responsible for 8% of all of Australia's domestic carbon emissions every year. 8% Wow. by itself is twice as big as the next worst polluter. It plans to keep burning coal until 2048, which is almost 20 years after the OECD has said we need to stop to have a chance of maintaining a safer climate. They've also got a spectacularly bad environmental record, the worst environmental license breach record of any of Australia's energy utilities. And if this company could change its ways and shift the whole of its business from burning coal to clean energy, and it does have a little bit of clean energy at the moment, they talk about it a lot, but 85% of what AGL produces comes from coal. But if they could go from being this filthiest of all companies in carbon pollution terms to being a clean energy giant, then we would be taking a massive step forward as a country. So this week, Greenpeace in Australia, in collaboration with some great other organisations, a shout out, for example, to ACCR, we have launched a great new campaign to persuade AGL to stop being Australia's greatest liability and instead to being a champion of clean energy. So what's on the to-do list? That's on the to-do list.
That's a big to-do list.
It is.
Hey, David, thank you so much for your time. I think you should add two more things to that to-do list. I reckon you deserve a big 50th. And
and we look forward to attending.
Yeah, and and maybe a Blues finals berth or premiership at some stage of the game. But that's very wishful. Like, that's nearly as seismic as the AGL goal or mission. Hey, mate, thank you so much for your time. Like, I think about this moment in time, and, you know, there are moments in our history and our lives that you really do need extraordinary people to show us the way and to lead us through to, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. And what we've experienced today is that you are that man, and the light, the love and the passion that you have for this globe of ours, this people of ours, and everything that makes it up is truly, truly inspirational. So thank you so much for your time.
Look, you're being overly kind. This is the great thing about the movement at the moment that we are in is that there are millions of us. There are millions of us because human beings are motivated by love. Human beings are social beings. And together we will get there. Together we will get there if we put our shoulders to the wheel.
And that we will. Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity to talk. Appreciate it.
There he was. What a passionate man. I think the standout thing for me was that I reckon it's actually more likely that we'll turn around global warming before Carlton win a premiership. I shouldn't make jokes about this stuff, but it's true.
Yeah, and for all of our international listeners out there, which is more than 30% of our audience is coming from across the globe, Carlton are an AFL, Australian Football League team, who used to be a powerhouse and now, thankfully, is a basket case.
Yes, that's true, and have been for some time. David Ritter, well, if you ever wanted to find an example of someone that is running after their purpose with so much passion and belief on a day-to-day basis, regardless of your politics and what you think, like, that is, David's a great example of just living what you believe in.
Yeah, and he articulates it really well as what he wants to do. He's you know, looking to make institutional change. And that, I think that's a good message for people out there, especially people who feel like my job, my role can't actually influence anything. And sure, you can make consumer-based habit change. That's easy, you know, go and buy the recycled toilet paper and think about things like that. But it's about making institutional change. So the business that you work for, the people that you do business with. So I really like the don't buy, don't supply and say why. Mm. You know, don't buy from places that support things that you don't believe in. Don't supply people who, you know, do things you don't believe in. And that's a big call out to the AFL around gambling.
Yeah.
If you could stop the gambling ads, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I don't think kids need to see that. And then saying why, being proud about the fact that you're going to use renewable energy, things like that. And it does sort of flow into, and those will remember our interviews with Rachel Lowry and Leslie Hughes. And we talked a little bit about being mindful of where your superannuation is actually being invested. A lot of people just put money in and then just think that's what, you know, the superannuation fund takes care of it.
Yeah.
But you can actually choose now in most super funds. And, you know, this is not to be taken as financial advice, of course, but you can get in there and choose, no, I want ethical investing choices or investing in other things that are other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Just recently, Elon Musk came out and said Bitcoin is actually not that environmentally friendly because of the amount of energy required to mine the coins.
Yeah.
So people are starting to look a little bit behind the curtain, so to speak, of these investment choices.
Yeah, I think we have to. You know, we have to do everything, whether it be that don't buy, don't supply, say why. You know, as Rachel Lowry suggested, think about who you're voting for.
Yeah,
how do we influence and shift institutional thinking? And but all you got to do is, if you've got a kid who is 15 or younger, and you know, have a chat to them about what they think about the impact of global warming, and look into their eyes and go, okay, well, we're going to make this place a better place for our kids and our kids' kids. And as you said, you know, we're on track to go to 3 degrees. And if that happens, our kids and their kids are in a lot of strife.
Yeah. So the good thing is there is hope.
There is.
And there's good people out there. There's the activists in Greenpeace. There are people who are doing different types of conservation work. But I will ask you this, Blake.
Hang on, Ray.
What's agape again?
Ooh, I tell you, the person that I do remember saying agape was Con the Fruiterer. Do you remember Con the Fruiterer?
I remember Con the Fruiterer. I don't know. How often did he reference agape?
All the time.
Really?
I think he had a daughter whose name was Agape. And it's to do with love.
Love for the world.
There it is.
Not a sort of love that you would have for me, or you'd have for your significant others or your family. It's a love for the world.
Yeah.
And it's a great word to turn into a philosophy. And that's one that David really believes in. It's why he's so passionate. It's why that there are 1.5 million supporters in the Australian Pacific region alone commit their $30 a month or $10 or whatever they want to contribute towards the fund. And no government funding, no fundraising activities that are, you know, considered part of that sort of sphere. So they are independent, which is really good.
Yep, sure is. I just got one more question for you before we wrap up.
Go for it.
Who are you going to put on your wall?
Now? Who am I going to put on my wall now? As in which football player or in general?
Just any poster.
Or Brian Cox. I quite like Brian Cox. I reckon him looking out into the stars or something like that.
Coxie. Like it.
How about you? Daryl, you've still got Daryl on the wall, haven't you?
I still do. Yeah. I think I'll leave him there.
Yeah.
I mean,
always looking.
Always watching.
Keeping a watchful
every
eye.
Movement. I'll never forget that. It was eerie.
Mm. Anyway. What a thought to end on. Yeah. Enjoy your day, Doolanders.
I think we need to get Daryl on.
If anyone knows Daryl Braithwaite, get in contact. Howdy@thedoolanders.com. Check out our website too, thedoolanders.com.
Love it.
Wait, the fade-up music's coming on top of me.
Here it is.
Stop it. Da, 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 da.